One, two, three, four.
I walked Miles Davis to his car with Bob Field Jr., whose dad produced Coltrane. And we're backstage at Hollywood Bowl, the last gig he ever played. And Miles asked me, who's that white boy? I said, it's Bob Field Jr., great music supervisor. He says, his dad produced Train? I said, yeah. Walked up to Bob and said, your father produced Train? He says, yeah. He says, well, you can hang. And permission. And we walked out. I did not know he was dying. I did not know he was sick. I kissed him on both cheeks, and 18 days later, he was dead.
Dr. Peter Weller is an American film and television actor, often recognized for his iconic roles in films such as RoboCop and Naked Lunch. Beyond his work in front of the camera, Dr. Weller has spent years immersing himself in art, history, and academia, earning a Master's of Arts degree in Roman and Renaissance Art from Syracuse University, and a PhD in Renaissance Art History from UCLA. His dissertation investigated Leon Battista Alberti's seminal writing, De Pictura, and this year he released his new book, Leon Battista Alberti in Exile, which dives deep into the life and legacy of the Renaissance genius. A fascinating exploration of one of the era's most influential figures, Weller traces the life of a man whose work shaped everything from architecture to humanist thought.
In this wide-ranging conversation, we discuss painting, jazz, film, and the importance of the arts. Dr. Peter Weller, welcome back to The Creative Process.
My pleasure.
The last time we spoke, we talked about your film and television career and the subject of your dissertation. You've made it into a book that's coming out here in Europe in March. What attracted you to Alberti?
Okay, Leon Battista Alberti. The interesting thing is that most people don't know who he is. Most people go, oh yeah, we know the Ninja Turtles, I keep referring to them. Michelangelo, Raffaello, Donatello. All those guys came out of Florence at one time or another. And subsequently, Florence is sort of the center of operations and so forth of what we call the Renaissance. Of course, scholars know who he is because he was a polymath, a poet, architect. We think he's a painter anyway. We don't have any evidence of that, but except he's a self-portrait, particularly an architect and a writer and a humanist. So here's the deal with this. I'm going to make a big distinction here. The Renaissance, which means rebirth in French, it's funny, a French word, yes, describes essentially a movement that happened in Italy, means the rebirth of antiquity. And when we say antiquity, we mean ancient Greece and Rome, starting with Alberti, with which he was obsessed. Now, when we say Renaissance, however, most people think, oh, it's the rebirth of the styles of antique painting and single-point perspective, the facility to take a three-dimensional image and transfer it perfectly to a two-dimensional plane so that you can feel you can walk into that road. Or you could walk into that church. That's one thing that comes out of the Renaissance. The other thing is that bronze sculpture comes back and all sorts of art techniques come back, oil painting, etc. But Renaissance really means the rebirth of books. And if everybody wants to see a good movie, see In the Name of the Rose, Umberto Eco's Nobel Prize winning book turned into an amazing movie with my friend Ron Perlman and Christian Slater and Sean Connery about the rediscovery of books. You want to see another great movie? See this movie with Rachel Weisz and Oscar Isaacs that was produced, by, I think, by Spain, England, France, Germany. It took a while to get on DVD here, called Agora. Agora means marketplace, like forum, right? And it is about the very last academy, that is, teaching facility in Latin and Greek, which the Romans did, until the early church said, no, all those books got to go. Why? Because they were before the birth of Christ and subsequently their pagan literature, and they got to go. So the ban on books, yes, is sadly, but most Christian scholars will tell you, and great priests will tell you too, that it starts with the ban on books. And the world goes dark. You got the Dark Ages. You got nobody reading, essentially, unless you're Charlemagne or somebody rich. And you got manuscripts, not only for ecclesiastical thing, but all these great tools of science, of astronomy, of medicine, of the globe, of all this great stuff that Alexander the Great wanted passed around and started a library, are gone. They're gone, 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 gone. And subsequently, around the 1200s, 1300s, somewhere in Italy, when Italy becomes the centerpiece for the need to control all of the goods and services coming out of the Levant. By Levant, I mean everything from Turkey all the way down to Egypt. All this, in spite of the fact we Europeans don't win a crusade, and probably rightfully so, because it was nonsense, but what it does is open up this trade and all the stuff starts pouring into Europe, and you need, you know, notaries and tax accountants and just regular accountants and lawyers and so forth to keep track of the stuff to disperse it. Venice becomes the center of that disbursement, and places around Venice become places where you go to school And so Bologna opens up thanks to Frederick Barbarossa, and it's not attached to a church. It's a school for accountants and medicine people. And all of a sudden, Italy gets this jumbo explosion of being the center of the disbursement of culture. But the culture that they're spreading is not art. The culture that they begin to spread are these books that they find where? In churches, because thank goodness some of those priests and abbots and archbishops and bishops said, you know what? Somebody's going to want to read this stuff one day. And in spite of the fact that, yeah, we're Christian, this doesn't really vilify my Christianity. So let's keep these things, man. Somebody's going to want to know what Ptolemy says about stars and so forth. Hence, this explosion of humanism is what the real Renaissance is. That's where Alberti comes in. So I'm walking around Florence. Long story to a good point. I'm walking around Florence doing a master's degree in art, and I'm a Johnny come lately to this. I'm a Johnny come lately to it because the great and beautiful Allie McGraw turned me on to art. I become a contemporary art nut, and then I'm doing the National Festival of Film in Japan with the great Mike Medavoy, producer of RoboCop and other great films, and the great Jean Moreau, the actress of Jules and Jim and Truffaut, genius actress, and Vittorio Storaro. Storaro is a gift. Storaro is one of probably the first guy to filter color photography, which we take for granted now, but back in the 60s, nobody did that. So he's amazing breakthrough artist of cinematography. And I asked him what his favorite painter is, and I'm thinking he's going to come out with somebody I know of, Rothko, you know, Jasper Johns, Larry Rivers. And he goes, have you been to Padua to see Giotto? I said, who? He says, Giotto. Giotto. G-I-O-T-T-O. In Padua, the Cappella Scrivenius. I don't know what you're talking about. He took his Versace scarf. He wears Versace all the time. Francis Ford Coppola said that Vittorio Storaro is the only person can survive 2 years in the jungles of the Philippines in a white suit. That's Vittorio. And he took his scarf, flipped it over his shoulder, and said, we got to talk about art. And I talked up to him. I said, you know, you're kind of pretentious, man. He goes, no, you're pretentious. You're pretentious like most Americans who can flippantly say, you know, that I'm into Rembrandt, or I'm into Cy Twombly, or I'm into Frank Stella, or I'm into Warhol. But you have no context unless you've seen Giotto. Because all of those painters that you like source Giotto. So I go, wow, man, Padua, what else is there? And so when I start to go there, I said, I got to learn about this. And so I take classes at Syracuse, thanks to the great Gary Radke. My mentor at Syracuse is emeritus. And I meet the great Rab Hatfield and others and Molly Bourne. And I take this year off during 3-union strike in my business. And I apply for master's degree there. They don't allow anybody in there, but I've sort of impressed Radke with my verve and enthusiasm, so he cuts some slack for me. And I get into this year-long program, and the year-long program is the hardest thing maybe I've ever done, because you've got to read paleography, that's Middle Italian, you've got to read a modicum of Latin, French, German. It's tough, man. You're doing the whole thing, basically the whole thing in Italy, thanks to Syracuse. And I'm lost, sort of, but the one thing I start to get on is I'm asking Molly Bourne and Hatfield, some other people are like, you know what, man? Florence is like a serpent eating its tail. You look for, like, what brought humanism to Florence? What brought these artists to Florence? It's not just money. And they go, Florence did. And, you know, it's so incestuous when you ask Florence, where's your source of your art? They'll say Florence. Florence is the source. You know, I'm going like, help me out here, guys. And thankfully, both Radke, and I'm a new guy. If I was a guy who had been studying a long time and I'd opened up books from Ronald Witt and John Richards and so forth and seen what Padua had to offer in terms of art and humanism, and it's the second oldest university. Some kids got tired of going to Bologna. They opened up their own university in 1226 in Padua. If I'd been studying this throughout my undergrad or something like that, I would have known it, but I didn't. I'm a new guy to it. I jumped in at the end. I jumped in on a master's degree. In spite of the fact that I could speak all those languages and study, I had very little training in art. As a matter of fact, the 5 people I was doing my master's degree with, some of them resented me being there because I had not gone through the whips and change of undergrad. When I'm asking this about where does stuff start, I would have probably known this. I'd have probably already been in Padua. I'd have known what Vittorio Storaro in 1992 was talking about, but I didn't. So I go to Padua, I see Giotto, and I say, oh my God. Then later on, I'm doing the master's degree. That summer session in 1998, I get qualified for the master's degree. I go, look, something's going on here. And they say, Padua, look to Padua.
Yeah, exactly. Because I've always, and I did study Succhi d'Erba in Florence. But my knowledge is of oil painting. I've studied, you know, the old fresco techniques too. But yes, you're just always taught that the source is Florence. And of course, they have amazing collections. But it's logical, as you say, like the rivers like flow to this place where the money was and everything. So explain how those threads, and you also brought up religion, and religion is often vilified, but where would we have our culture? Who was writing this down? Who were the scholars? If we didn't have religion, like so much of this would be lost. And, you know, frankly, who would be paying for all this beauty? You know, the pretext of religion or the pretext or the power of upholding that. You can't take away religion, you know, it's going to lose the beauty and the history. That's one thing in its favor, despite everything else that we've had. You know, I won't say that's all good.
Well, your point about religion is great. I mean, I consider myself a sort of a weak Jewish version of a Catholic. I'm one of those guys who looks at Jesus as a Jew, and I go to Mass, and I also go to, I herald the traditions of religion. And when the traditions of religion are taught from a pulpit, a drash, or a homily, whatever, and it doesn't matter whether it's Shintoism or Buddhism, and I do as Zen meditation, yes, I herald it. We got to separate what you said. The early church is a movement and becomes a little bit nuts with its vilification of anything that came before Christ. And subsequently, the ban on books and the burning of books is basically an axiom of all fundamentalism. It's everything's got to go but us, which is the sad news. It doesn't matter if it's fundamentalist religion or fundamentalist governments. Everything's got to go but us. Hopefully, we're not having a rebound of that around the world right now. But the point is that thank God that people of service in religion are the people that kept these books. They saved them, you know, the monasteries and the cathedrals and the abbeys and so forth. Put it in the basement. Somebody comes riding by like F. Murray Abraham in his Dominican garb. Yeah, tell him, no, man. Yeah, we did it. We burned them. They're gone. And thank God we've got them, thanks to religion. And then subsequently, when the humanism explodes, when the ideas of Plato and Aristotle and Marshall and Cicero and on and on and on and Quintilian and ethics and rhetoric explode into, where do they explode? Their books are found in Italy, so they explode in Italy, and people start reading them. Does this bump with the church? No, because you got Padua, which is a sort of a collective after the Carrera of Venice, but even before then, it turns its head to the law and said, yeah, let's read this stuff. So you got Petrarch, and you can't look at humanism without Petrarch. He's the granddaddy of rediscovery of it, the guy who heralds Rome as the center of culture and so forth. The guy that heralds Rome is the place that took everything Alexander was spreading, Hellenism, and made it into a monumental thousand-year feast of what? Marketing, architecture, plays, philosophy, science, on and on. And Padua becomes a place of disbursement.
Yeah, so really a cradle of culture. And we should say that the full title of your book, Leon Battista Alberti in Exile, Tracing the Path to the First Modern Book on Painting, because many say that Alberti's real contributions, he was a polymath, he was, I think a lot of people think of him as an architect.
Right.
It was his contributions to writing, to helping us understand and remember, and that's why they say was his genius. And I guess he was also a very good man. Vasari said a lot of good things about him as a person. A gentleman, you know, maybe he was like the Wild. He put his genius into his life and then into his writings. So not into the art, but into his life. It seems from what I read of him in Vasari. So take apart just the title, Alberti in Exile. So his father was in exile?
Yep.
So that's why he developed outside of Florence, like he was culturally informed outside of Florence.
Correct. His father was in exile from the late 1300s. A lot of people were exiled. This is the period of time in the 1300s, which is manifest. You just can't, I used to be the guy that said, oh, the Renaissance started in the 1400s. Well, that's easy to do because that's the jump off place with the art. But the art is evolving, the humanism is evolving, everything's evolving, the discovery of books is evolving. And the 1300s is a time when now you got interstate highways, you got great Holy Roman emperors leaving money and banking like the Hohenstaufen family, and David Abulafia's great book on Frederick II, it comes out. Frederick II is one of my heroes, by the way, a humanist hero. But so you've got this trade thing, you've got this exchange thing going in the 1300s. And this is after the Black Death. And as Barbara Tuchman, another great movie guy, John Milius, who wrote Apocalypse Now and some other astounding movies, I sat with John many times to talk about Barbara Tuchman, Barbara Tuchman's books, The Distant Mirror, and one of the greatest stories that got me into the fabric of this, because The Distant Mirror is about the tragedy of the Black Death paralleling. She wrote it before HIV and AIDS, but paralleling the 20th century and influenza and so forth. I've got to remember the Black Death took out over a third of the population from India to Iceland. So humanism, art, everything goes on stall mode. And when it's over, everybody's jumping out of the bag to go collect and own and whatever. The only place it isn't, I think, you know, call me a Venice-ophile, but I kind of am. Venice has got a republic that lasts for 1,000 years, you know, and they got checks and balances and stuff. They're going to make sure that there's no one family going to jump out of the bag after the Black Death and get control of guilds, get control of populace, get control of money, get control of whatever. But that's what happens in Florence.
I wanted to trace back. You said about what drew you to the Renaissance, and you mentioned Giotto. You mentioned there's so many figures, but what is it particularly about Alberti or about this uncovered aspect that people didn't really focus on? People were always joining him to Florence, as I understood. So what makes him a singular figure for you that it just attracted your imagination?
Anger at a diatribe and a conceit that was promoted by a particular cultural group, you know, a postmodern group who said, oh, and this amazing book on painting, which, by the way, everyone has to read. There's two versions of it. There's one in Latin and there's one in Italian translated in English. And there's a letter in front of the Italian version that thanks all of these people, Donatello, Masaccio, Ghiberti, Luca Della Robbia. You have to read this. You have to read it. And the take on this letter that he's writing is that he came to Florence and wrote this amazing book in 9 months to a year. He just saw these guys and went, oh, wow, I'm going to write this book in tripartite Ciceronian Latin and bring up all of antiquity and all of these things, lines, points, measures, depth, color, these theories, and put them in a book in 1 year because I came to Florence and saw these guys. I say, you know, pardon the expression on your podcast, horse shit. And so when I read this, all these takes on what Alberti did, that's the thing that got me jammed on this, on Alberti. Because it's the first modern book on painting. It's in three parts. I'm a mediocre to poor Latinist, but I'm a Cicero obsessive, and I'm a Quintilian obsessive. I still don't know enough. I read those guys all the time. But his sources of the Latin guys and his sources of Greco-Roman gifts to art and architecture, you know, come on, man. This guy didn't come to Florence to write this book in 9 months. I walk around asking these professors, and it's funny, you know, because I'm asking of some famous people from England all the way to Italy. I go, guys, you know, the inference here is that he came to Florence and went, wow, I wrote this book. And everyone, I talked to 20 people, everyone except one said, Peter, everybody knows that. I said, well, why isn't it taught? It's not taught. It's taught that he comes to Florence and becomes a smarty pants. Why isn't his history taught? They go, why don't you teach it? Five of these guys said, you write it. I said, you want me to be the scapegoat here, man, for like 40 people to come out of the woodwork? And by the way, art history competition is truly pretentious and very aggravating, as you well know, man.
I know a little bit about academia.
Yeah, like what Henry Kissinger said, there's so much competition in academia because there's so little at stake, right? So just people regurgitating opinions. I just want to say I belong to a country club. That's as pretentious as you can get. I play golf there. That's what I like. Okay, about 2 years ago, I was sitting out with 15 of my friends who've been to Italy with me, who I've taken by the hand and shown them the art. They love going to Italy with me. I love taking them to Italy. And I sit down and one of them, a dear friend of mine, named Luke, and another guy named Brad, one's a lawyer, one's an entrepreneur. And they say, hey, Peter, we have another doctor at the table in academia. She's brilliant. She's from Harvard. Her name is Cynthia Friend. She's a gifted person from Harvard, scientist. She's a great athlete and so forth, and extraordinarily presenting, gorgeous woman. And so I say, oh, a Dr. Friend, how are you? And I'm going to quote her now. I hope she doesn't sue me, but she said a great thing. She says, you have a PhD? I said, yeah. Where from? I said, UCLA. I said, and she doesn't Harvard me. There's a thing I want to tell you that you know. People from Harvard or Oxford, you, in the first 20 seconds you meet them. You could say Neil Armstrong went to the moon. They go, yeah, well, I was at Harvard. And that's true, man. Oxford, same way. You know, you could say, look, the bomb was dropped. Yeah, but when that guy went to Oxford, you think, my God. So anyway, Cynthia does not Harvard me at all. She goes, oh, what did you study? I said, well, what did you study? And there's like a whole bunch of people there. I think she's got like genetics and biochemical engineering and I think medicine. And she's a polymath. She's the head of the chair emeritus, I think, in one of the science chairs. And she says, what did you study? And I said, well, alas, something far more pretentious than you. Out of pause, she says, oh, it must be art history. And the whole table erupts into hysteria. And a friend of mine, Brian Wozniak, says, why is art history considered so pretentious? I said, well, Brian, we need culture as human beings. Like you said, you know, the great thing about religion, it saved culture and it promoted culture. But at the same time, the idea of culture through art doesn't look to the common Joe who's thinking about the end of the world or the end of days or how to save his kid from cancer or whatever. It doesn't look like it's necessary. It doesn't look like it's needed. It looks like a thrill, a tap dance. Compared to sciences.
I want to say, I'm wondering at what point does your background as kind of an outsider, where Alberti, from your perspective, it kind of like makes sense. He was an outsider. Even his father was exiled and then they come back, and then he finds himself back in the firmament. And in a way, he's writing these books, not just on painting, but also a very important treatise on architecture and many others. It's his way of those who tell the stories control the narrative or write history. So you're kind of an outsider. I mean, you talk about Italy, you have a home in Positano, and also I believe you were born in Wisconsin, which is like the furthest away from Los Angeles or New York. You know, like, so you, it feels to me, oh, that kind of chimed with like your understanding of you could be formed. Now you're at home in these places, but you still retain that. Explain how that maybe helped you understand Italy as a place of, you know, many provinces, in distinct cultures, and it's all still preserved. But even at that time, Italian wasn't just the dominant one. You have all these different dialects spoken that are quite different. How was that perhaps a way in? You're being an outsider in a way. To understanding Alberti and his point
of view.
Well,
at first, I have to say, I was the ugly American. I mean, I was Mark Twain's version of it. I was sent to Italy essentially by Ali. I was amazed and confused and dazed and so forth. But I would run through Italy absorbing its food, essentially, and its buildings and looking at the art, but not ever trying to understand it. And there were places that I warned people away from. I mean, I warned people for 8 years. I warned people away from Venice. Don't go to Venice. It's a puke hole. It's overloaded with tourists. It's like that, la, la, la. It's a, you know, who wants to go? I was skimming the top of the culture of Europe, and I was embarrassed into learning the language some years after by a great friend of mine, Philippe Colon, French Lebanese, who said, Peter, you know, we come to United States and we all speak English, and you come to Paris and you go to Rome and we all speak English. I thought, gosh.
Yeah.
So
it's sadly true. Yes.
Yes, but I was not that guy who just did a deep dive into it. I was the guy who was surfboarding it. And until Philippe did this, I called up Ali and said, look, you speak five languages. What do I do here? I've been going to Italy for 8 years now, man. I don't speak any of this stuff, man. She goes, yeah, get a kid, get somebody, get whoever to come to your house. And A, don't miss the lesson. And B, even if you don't do the homework or whatever, don't miss the lesson. And you got to be willing to make an ass out of yourself. To learn a language, you've got to be willing.
Get your hands dirty and yeah,
you got to get your hands dirty. You got to go and take your book and say, je voudrais vers de l'eau. You got to do that. And if you don't do that, and the Parisians are horrible. I mean, they're better now, by the way. They're better now because they had a come to, pardon the expression, Jesus meeting, I think, with the Minister of Culture and so forth. Said these.
Yeah, Operation Bonjour, I think it was called.
Yeah, yes, that's right. And now the waiters are friendly again. Like Max Ernst said, I've never met anybody happier than the garçon dans la rue de Paris.
You know I'm in Paris. Right?
I know you're in Paris. So il faut qu'on parle de France, de Paris, parce que tu es à Paris maintenant, and j'ai appris le français avec un Parisien. Yeah, a guy, I call up a guy.
C'est un très bon accent.
Merci, mais j'ai appris le français avec le créole. Le créole and Saint-Barthélemy and Nouvelle-Orléans and toutes mes amis. L'accent. Et c'est mieux, mais quand j'ai essayé la première fois, apprendre le français était un désastre.
But we'll go back into English just to make sure listeners understand.
So I took the book around. I learned French. I learned to get on in France. And I knew that I could speak it after 2 years of trying to work it. I was in a taxi cab in Paris. And this guy was giving me so much jam, man. And I finally just said, parle mon cul, ma tête est malade. And got it.
We won't translate that one.
And I got out of the cab and I went, wow, I can speak French now. Yeah. So then I started learning Italian. When Storaro was telling me about, you got to go see Giotto. And I called up Ali and I said, why don't you talk about Giotto? She says, I did, but you had no interest in the Renaissance. You were only interested in the contemporary people and the modern people, in the Chagalls and the Matisses and whatever. I go, really? She says, yeah, I said Giotto all the time, but you had no clue. So when I go back and see Giotto, and I thank these people in this book and also on the acknowledgement page, that's what takes me deep into it. That's where I go and look back at my life and say, thank God my mother took me to see the Berlin Philharmonic do Beethoven's Ninth. Thank God my mother took me to see the flamenco reunion of, you know, all the great flamenco dancers. And thank God my mother took me to see Jazz at the Philharmonic. I didn't want to go to any of this stuff. Thank God my mother made me play music. My mother was the cultural addict. But thank God my dad gave me the discipline to get up and go. And my dad was the guy who always said, you got to go to Italy. He called it Italy, right? So you think you're eating Italian food? Says, you got to go to Italy, sit on the streets of Rome and have them bring it out to you in a frying pan. This is immigrant food from the United States. There's no such thing as a sauce in Rome. They just throw stuff in a frying pan, throw it on your plate. I thought he's out of his mind. Until I went to Rome And I think, oh my gosh, what have I been eating?
I think it's great, a breath of fresh air into, as you say, the pretentious art historian academic community, that you have this background as an actor, director, musician, now writer, that you have this storytelling background, getting into character, understanding that there's human emotions. So much, so often in academia, we can forget. And you just have to stand in front of a Renaissance painting and you understand this is flesh and blood. These are dramas. And whether it's based on religious themes or going back to ancient sources, it's so fresh. And when I go, and I'm sorry, because our historical knowledge of Italy is focused mostly around Firenze, also a little bit in Venice, but, you know, I love them.
I forgive
too.
You.
I didn't have as much immersion in all the different provinces, but, you know, you stand in front of some of those paintings and they come alive. There's a Bronzino, Laura Battifieri. That one haunts me. I don't know if you know, she's in profile. She looks like a crow. She was a poetess. Yeah. Like more than his beautiful ones. But anyway, that's so powerful. If you go back to Uffizi and to see it, yeah, they're really living characters. And I think that that's really essential that we can forget in the art academic writing. So I think that your background in acting, directing, film, and television is perfect. Like, we need to be reminded. It's not history. They're just like, they're people. And it's so alive to my mind.
Well, the thing that you celebrate Florence for, and I wish more Americans would do it in spite of the fact that the hours are weird, but the great churches, whether you, yes, look, that, you know, I did a seminar at 16th Century Society on Renaissance art to modern film. And that's like, people went in those churches to see the Sistine Chapel or whatever. But there's the Medici, there's the writers. And that, yeah, it was a movie to them. It was a movie. You have essentially many times people are starting to learn again, but crowd who want to go in and learn by vision. And so those are movies, man. There's no doubt about it. All the way back to the Greeks putting something on a pedestal or the Romans putting something on a wall. That's a movie. That's like, here's the procedures of Diana that you can see in Pompeii. So the thing about Florence is also, though, Florence has a couple of museums that don't get the attention. And one is the Duomo Museum. Wow. What is in the Duomo Museum? Everybody from Donatello to Michelangelo to everybody you want to know. And how many people go in there? People that might beef with Florence is people will stand in front of the gates of paradise or turn around and look at the facade, not realizing the facade is like a 19th century thing made with machines of the Duomo. There is no handmade facade of the Duomo. If you want to see the facade, go to Santa Maria Novella and see Alberti's facade. But this is a mock-up facade. It's nice, but then you turn around and look at the gates of paradise. Those are the reprints. Those are redos. The real ones are in the museum around the corner. And while you're on the way, look at the Porta della Mandorla of Nanni di Manco and Donatello and everybody else and Ghiberti. But you got to go in those. You got to go in the Bargello. Look at the Bargello. What's that? That's got two of the cataclysmically cornerstone Donatellos ever, right? First got published on Donatello, 21st century icon, Donatello's David, and Michelangelo, and the Brutus, and everybody in there. But those places, even in Florence, don't get the attention. The Uffizi is a gift and remarkable. And you can end with Caravaggio's Medusa, and you walk outside and you see Cellini, one of the great, if not the largest single bronze ever done in antiquity or now. But you got to go in these other places in Florence. And that's my beef with Florence. I don't herald enough the gold mines of art like Santo Spirito and on the other side of Alto Arno, where that's my favorite hang over there, and the Bargello and the Duomo. But that's Florence, you know. Florence, you can go brain dead looking at art. Let's face it, man. The Stendhal syndrome. The Stendhal syndrome is true. Stendhal said you walk around Florence enough, you know, you realize you're a grain of sand, you're diminished.
You're getting a high.
You're going to go into depression because guess what? You are like the grain of sand on the beach called the Renaissance, man, and you don't mean nothing. So you can get overwhelmed by it.
It's true. And so that's why it's nice to go, and not just in Florence, but to go in the different churches throughout Italy or the smaller museums where the churches particularly, because it was made for that. It's in situ. It's not taken to a museum. This has such a sense of intimacy and it was created. They were site-specific, you know, artworks. And that's a really nice experience that you get throughout Italy. Yeah, so I really like that you shine the light on these kind of aspects in your mind, you know, for people who are maybe doing that tour of Italy or don't know it so well, that there's all these, hey, here's another corner, let's shine a light on that. We can forget about that. You know, I want to talk a little bit about your acting and directing. Well, I do want to talk about the art too, but I feel like a certain responsibility. Oh, and thank you so much. We should say publicly that Dr. Peter Weller also contributed a very moving and intimate essay for our recently published that I co-edited, contributing editor of the Jazz and Literature for Routledge. And you wrote a very beautiful and moving essay about your friend, Miles Davis, who
yes.
I was just looking behind you on the wall is a self-portrait of Miles Davis. So you really knew him and you saw him, of course, you know, right up until the end.
Yep. It's excerpts from a diary that I was keeping since a teenager. The thing is, I was talking about go to UCLA, go Syracuse and go Cambridge and every other school I've been part of, but North Texas and University of Texas. So I was yesterday at UCLA talking to the heads of the film department because I teach a workshop there. And one of my friends there, Tiger Bello, what a great name. She said, you know, I read your thing about Davis. She wrote a beautiful deal about it. And the second I start talking about it, I get weepy because it's my mom. And my mom just infused me with music. And I was not the guy who was, I had no Mozart capabilities, you know, I was going to play Bach at the age of 3 and all that, man. And I played music because my mother told me to. I wanted to quit all the time. My kid wants to quit. Then he plays it and he's good and he wants to quit. But he's like my mom. My mom says, you're not going to quit music. You can go to college and quit music, but you ain't going to quit as long as you're living in this house. So I didn't quit. But so when, you know, the people I hear, Beethoven or Ravel or Chopin, particularly Duke Ellington and Miles, you know, it just, my mom just goes, my mom would say, sit, listen to this, listen to these violins, listen to this piano go, listen to this. And I would listen to it. And, you know, yes, be a 10-year-old bored kid or a 12-year-old bored kid for about 20 seconds. And then you start hearing the left hand to Chopin, and it's almost like rock. It's amazing. You get somebody lead you by the hand. And as Ernst Gombrich said, and I'm paraphrasing with the great Ernst Gombrich, who's, by the way, everybody's listening to this, pick up the book, Story of Art, Ernst Gombrich, put it by your bedside. If you know nothing about art, I didn't. I pick up that book. I read a little bit at a time. It'll walk you through the caves of Velasco all the way to, you know, Piet Mondrian's color theory, man. But he said, you know, this thing that also makes me weepy. You don't know what you like. This whole contemporary art fad. Hey, I know what I like. I don't like that. Yeah, you do. It's not that you don't know what you like. You don't know what you like. If somebody takes you by the hand and walks you through it, walks you through the connective tissue of all the imagery on a cave all the way up to Piet Mondrian, you're going to like it. It may not be your favorite, but you're certainly going to get your head around it. A banker stood with me in the middle of my cigar club saying, I don't get these big black squares. I said, I walked him backwards through cubism into, real simply, Cezanne. And thanks to Marianne Kalo at Cornell, who explained the whole Cezanne thing to me. About Cezanne, and Cezanne took Impressionism and he edged it with black. You know, usually all this green or all these fields going up a mountain. You go, what is with that? Well, you look closer. He's edged every single square, rectangle, triangle in it. And you see the mathematics of the thing jump out. And I'm walking him back to that. And then I walk him back to Piero della Francesca, who Cezanne sourced because della Francesca was the guy who said, nature, looking at nature, is all mathematical. If you look a little bit longer, you'll see the perfect mathematics in a leaf, the perfect mathematics in a tree, an acorn, everything. Has the perfect mathematics, which is God-given. So he essentially said the same thing that Einstein was saying. Science is God, you know? All it is our attempt to explain God through numbers and stuff. And so my friend Davey, the banker, at the end of it was going, it's not me. It's not a gift. Somebody walked me through it. Somebody took me from the squares and the circles and the whatever of the Greeks and so forth into the abstraction of the Middle Ages and when they couldn't figure it out, they lost again and they got the numbers again. And they start doing realism, and they go, no, it's not the realism. It's the image of the realism. And you got impressionism, and then the post-impressionists come along and says, not the impressionism of the thing. It's sort of how the mathematics that pop out of how the sun hits it. And then you got cubism, and you go, Carlo Caron, you go on and on. And you can think, none of this stuff is self-invented. Nobody, Jackson Pollock didn't just sit down and go, hey, I'm going to throw a lot of paint down here and call it action. No, it all comes out of an organic movement. And Ernst Gombrich says, you don't know what you like what you know. And if somebody's going to take you by the hand and walk you through it, in the land of truth, there is no path, as Buddha said, you're going to like it.
Yeah, well, that's the great challenge, I think, is to be able to maintain that innocence of like first impressions of actually seeing a thing without all the layers of what you should or what you've been taught. Like, have that knowledge, but then also keep fresh. So I'm wondering, I'm very jealous of musicians, and I'm wondering, I do feel like it all comes down to those harmonies, like that tuning in, whether it's acting or directing or getting the rhythms, or even with painting, which seems so solitary. It's a physical act, a movement, and just for me as a painter, tuning into the harmonies of nature, what I'm seeing or feeling. I'm wondering how being a musician has helped you in those other artistic roles that you've played through the years.
Some guy in the 1800s said that all art can only aspire to music, because everything is interpretive, but music is a sensory perception inside you, and you can't mess with it. So it doesn't matter what's, you know, dance or poetry or any kind of literature or visual art or whatever, it's music. And, you know, it's proven to me, anyway, at certain periods of time, like the late 1800s when music just dominated all the arts. And then again, from, say, 63 to 73 in the Western world, music was on the cutting edge, and there was a social revolution going on for sure in all its various shapes and forms, whether it be gender, race, or money, that music was on the forefront of. And I was so fortunate to grow up in that. And people are worried about the world now, man. Go live in 1968 and see what that was like, with everybody preparing to go to the moon at the same time, man, people dying on the streets for what they believed in. A difficult time in a republic to die. Difficult time in a republic that's supposed to be free when it's going to die. It doesn't matter what your political philosophy is. But music was leading the way. And if it wasn't a new album, it doesn't matter what it was. Whether it was Miles or Coltrane or Aretha or Leonard Cohen or Dylan or the Stones or the Beatles or Hendrix or Cream or Velvet Underground. Out of that, about 71, we get Ramones and so forth. Extraordinarily influential music. It's on the cutting. It's way before theater arts. It's way before dance arts. Way before poetic or literature arts. That music, there was an album, a Zappa, a something coming out every month. There was something. And it was all interpretive, it was all inside you. And it riled you and made you happy and sad at the same time. And man, I couldn't believe Otis has got a new album out. Man, wait a minute. Just listen to the Coltrane album. I got to go to listen to Otis now. You got to go. And you got to go to listen to the Who. Wait a minute. Hendrix just, so 10 years of extraordinary cutting edge stuff. So music is my thing, and I'm highly mediocre at it. And I got to go in right after you and play the trumpet for an hour. And I like playing the trumpet when I don't have a gig coming up. And then I hate playing the trumpet when I do have a gig coming up. How that goes?
Yeah, it's not playing anymore.
It's not playing anymore. It's rehearsing, gig, man. And you know, you paint when you're painting for yourself. But if somebody commissions something from you, then you got to go, oh. But I want to go back to what you said about walking into a room and looking at stuff. I don't know whether it's Rembrandt. I read something that Rembrandt said, you know, one of the first right brain, left brain guys. He said he never, never, never looked at the thing until it was done. He never stood back and looked at it. If he ever had a critical moment, and I'm totally paraphrasing this because I read it easy 30 years ago, that he would get up in the middle of the night if he had a problem with something like that apple or the person's hand or the mouth or whatever. Get up in the middle of the night, you know, with a candle and look at like 6 inches of the painting and be critical of whether or not that was correct. But the second that he stood back and was critical of the painting, he would hate it. And he would start to do it all over again. So you can't do that. It's like writing. You know this. Jane Bolker wrote the great thing, writing anything in 15 minutes a day, writing your dissertation 15 minutes a day. There's a zero draft. I mean, I would have never finished my dissertation or this book without reading Jane Bolker, who said in art, particularly writing, you've got to sit down and write it. The first thing in the morning, write and commit to a very small time. It'll turn into a long time. You're not going to do the 8 hours on a Friday. But you can do 15 minutes every morning from 6 to 6:15, right? But you got to do the zero draft. And Rembrandt, that guy, he's not a guy in a diner about painting, Rembrandt. Don't start critiquing your stuff until you finish the thing. Then you can go back and do left.
Yeah, it's about switching off. And I think that...
Well, what do you do?
Conversations.
Do you finish it first? Or do you go back and redo? Or what do you do?
Well, for me, because I did so many portraits and stuff, so it depends on which. But I write like jazz. I paint like, I don't know, surgery.
Oh, you do?
Like, no, because I have the idea and then to get what it needs to be for that kind of painting, which isn't totally realist, kind of dreamy, but like semi-transparent, like all this stuff or faces. Like I painted Miles Davis a few times. I mean, I didn't get to meet him. I painted his portrait, but it's in the book and the back pages. But, you know, it does have to be a little bit surgical. So I do feel it all the time. But when I'm writing, I'm so free. I just love it. And it's a very weird thing for me, and I'll talk about myself just a tiny bit. I can write very quickly. In fact, I'm so sad about AI because I thought like I was the fastest writer. Like it's like this. I would just, and it just comes out and I have such fun. And I didn't think it was great, but then people said it was good. And so I just keep on doing that. And I love that. So that's where I'm jazz. And then when I'm painting, it takes forever. But, you know, it's the idea comes quick, but then you have to layer. It's like it's oil painting. But Sage has been so patient.
Okay, Sage, come on.
Before we dive deeper into Peter Weller's incredible life and career, I wanted to take a moment to reflect on something that really struck me during our conversation. His profound understanding of the intricate web that connects people, movements, and history, and how these connections resonate through all forms of art. Despite being somewhat of an outsider himself, he has been able to carve out his own private Idaho among curious people across the globe. Peter spoke with such clarity about how music, film, and even the great artworks of the Renaissance are not isolated in silos, but rather deeply intertwined. It was fascinating to hear him explore how these different forms of expression across centuries influence and inform one another. In his words, art doesn't live in a vacuum. It breathes and evolves, shaped by the forces and experiences of the people creating it. What I found particularly inspiring was how Peter's own life experience has played such a pivotal role in shaping his complex understanding of art and culture. It's clear that his journey through different disciplines, languages, and cultures have gifted him with a unique lens through which he views the world. In a way, it's not just his work on screen or his artistic endeavors that shape his perspective, but his life itself, a life that mirrors the connective tissues of the art he so deeply admires. This is more than just intellectual curiosity. It's a way of living, of leaving the cave and entering a deeply beautiful and intertwined world beyond the shadows. It was this insight into both the chaos and continuity of the human expression that left me reflecting long after our conversation ended. So with that in mind, let's continue our exploration with Peter and delve further into the powerful intersections of art and life. I guess I sort of had my first question about the many hats you sort of wear as a musician, as well as an art historian and a television and film actor. And you played also a similar role of a polymath in The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. So I was curious how sort of playing that role in your personal life, in your film career, has, going back to the book on Alberti, influenced your understanding of his life, as well as how you kind of constructed the narrative of his work and his ideas.
The first thing I got to tell you is that there's no one who does a whole lot of stuff ever thinks they're doing enough. And, you know, the genius of all of the guy who did all kinds of stuff, from engineer to painting to whatever, there's Leonardo. And Leonardo said that curiosity, he told Francois Premier before he passed away, that curiosity was the carrot in front of the donkey with his life, but he didn't think that he'd accomplished enough. So I get this stuff done. I don't listen to myself about what I've accomplished. Once in a while, I got to take stock and let my wife and kid go, hooray for you, hooray for you. But essentially what it is, it's a forward path. It's constantly a forward path. I got to get up in the morning. I got to meditate. I got to go to the gym. I got to take the kids to school and got to come back. And I've got to write and play the trumpet and play some guitar and write four or five things. Look, I got to finish a paper on my favorite painter and I got to give it to the Renaissance Society in Boston. I got to go to Gibraltar, the Hoi Toi Mediterranean Society. I got to do a paper there. Got to do a couple of personal appearances where, you know, for Sacre Cash, you go out and meet fans. I've got to possibly act in a thing. But if I stop and look, it's a whole basket full of stuff, then I ain't going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. I got to have a goal. I got to write it down, Sage. I got to say, this is what I'm working on. And also, I got to eat the dirt of disappointment and the disappointment in everybody's life. You know, the disappointment is, wow, I didn't get that done. I didn't get this done. And so even when you're reading Leonardo, he's disappointed that of all the stuff that he didn't get done, and I go, oh my gosh. Okay, is the helicopter and the parachute just not enough? Forget the Mona Lisa and, you know, uphill water drainage. So it's just a commitment to get up and do. It's a commitment to get up and do. Take care of my health, get up and do. That's all it is. I mean, I wish I was Buckaroo Banzai. You know, I wish I knew the pineal tumor and could play rock guitar like that, you know? I could be a mediocre piano player, pretty good trumpet player, entirely mediocre guitar player, but I'm not a scientist. And my kid is totally into tachyons and atoms breaking, and she's explaining this stuff to me. thing you can do is, I'm going to say this, no matter how you have it or do it, but I recommend having a kid in your life at some point in time.
So I have a lot of questions specifically about your film career as well. I was curious about what you've learned from your art historical experience about composition and the ideas of space and symmetry, as well as what you talked about before with the artworks being movies in and of themselves, how those styles and ways of composing art have influenced cinema, both your cinema as well as classical and into like the modern period.
Well, the first thing is that the framing of, I've gotten into several beefs with guys who are operators, and the sad thing I find now is people got out of film school, haven't looked at enough art. And thank God people like Mike Nichols and Sidney Lumet got me looking at art, you know, even before I was interested in art, because this is a frame of this, and this is what this is, looks like, and you got to go see Pio della Francesca and Arezzo, and I said, no, I ain't going to Arezzo, and who the hell Mike Nichols was talking about, but later on, you see that the framing of film, the great framing of films is the great shots of film, particularly from Italy, those guys. Doesn't matter if you're talking to Rossellini all the way up to De Sica, Fellini, Antonioni, on. They knew how to frame because they're looking at art. Scorsese knows how to frame because he looks at art. Coppola knows how to frame because he looks at art. So looking at the art will tell you what to shoot or how to shoot it. You know, we're back to what Mia was talking about Florence. I did a thing as a graduate. It was a graduate project by taking undergrads, my graduate projects, through four of the Last Suppers in Florence. And there's a Ghirlandaio, and there's a Del Sarto, and there's a Castagno, and there's Taddeo Gaddi, and from all the way through the early stages of the Renaissance, and how they frame the Last Supper, and how they set up the drama of the Last Supper, and who is who in the Last Supper, and what the color scheme is of these Last Suppers. And one of them that a lot of people in San Apollonia, the one of the Castagno, my favorite one, you got to Google this, Castagno, Last Supper, Florence. Look at the explosion of contemporary art in that thing and the framing of it. And so that's a framing story right there. That's all movies. It's all movies. And so it all affected me. But it didn't really start affecting me until I had my nose rubbed in it by Ali McGraw and Vittorio Storaro. Look, got to go see this, got to go see this. Because the people that were referring to the art before that, I just thought they were like smart guys. Like, I just thought, oh, Sidney Lumet is hanging out with art guys. Because, I mean, look at the films that Sidney Lumet made. Look at the phenomenal access to painting and sculpture this guy had. Or Mike. These are the two godfathers of me. That's interesting. You care. Wait a minute. You had Sidney Lumet. You had Mike Nichols as the godfathers of your career. And you weren't going to see art until Ali McGraw had to jam you into Picasso exhibit in MoMA. And I go, yeah, that's me. The second he said cut, I was at Studio 54. I was not going off to an art museum, man. I did not go to Italy, just like I said to Mia, to run around and look at Michelangelo. No, I went around to Italy for the food and the walk and the jam and the fun and the street and the scene. So I had to be shoved into it. It did not come to me organically. But once I was in it and once my head's woken up, I go, wow. Now, that said, I got these four or five friends. We aren't politically on the same page at all, but we are artistically on the same page and we all go to Italy together or meet there. And it's my pleasure to do a deep dive for them into Giotto, Castagno, Del Sarto, Michelangelo, Florence. And I'm going with them again to Florence because they don't think they've done enough to Florence. I said, okay, we're going to go. So it's all film. It's all impressed me. It never really took, look, I got to say once again, people think like, wow, you've done all this stuff. I never really started doing this stuff until I was in my 40s. I'd given up jazz. I only started playing jazz again when I was 32. I'd given it up for 14 years. I only started learning a language, French, when I 40, yeah. And that took me Italian, so what? I never went to Italy for the art jam until Storaro told me to. So I was the ugly American. I was not hip savant that like, oh man, I'm going to go to Paris and dig the Louvre. No, I was bored to death in the Louvre. You know what? Somebody took me to the Louvre in 1978 and she said, a great woman named Diana Maxwell, I hope she's still with us, but she said, listen, we're going to look at a couple of things. I said, no, I want to see the Louvre. She said, you'll be brain dead. You'll be brain dead in the Louvre. Pick a couple of things. Pick like the Napoleonic court painters or the Greek guys or Caravaggio. Something. I said, I don't even know who those people are. Why don't we just walk it? Indeed, within 90 minutes in the Louvre, I could not wait to stab somebody with a fork or pour jello down my throat, man, because your brain can't hold it. So I was not the guy who was going to tell you what to see at the Louvre. I was not that guy. I became that guy, thank God. And I think I've done a service by providing it back to people. But movies was my access to it. So there.
I studied at the University of Bologna.
You studied at the University of Bologna?
Yeah.
The greatest, so the first civic university in the world.
I was curious to ask how the university structure and the city structure, as well as the culture of Italy, influenced Alberti. I know in your book, you talked about how he was sort of disillusioned, as well as how student life and the university setting across the world influences artists, young artists, in their perspectives.
Here's my two cents, and you can read the book. By the way, if you don't read the book, just look at the pictures. The pictures will walk you through the Renaissance a lot. But here's the thing with Alberti. I can understand why Alberti was flustered with college, with the university. Because Alberti, in exile, as Mia was pointing out, his family is exiled, so his father's working in Venice, and he plunks Leon Battista and his brother in this amazingly progressive humanist school, which there are none, really. I mean, even in Florence, they're learning lyric poetry, knight chivalry, and all that stuff, which is not bad. You know, it all comes from the organization of Europe, thanks to Holy Roman Empire and so forth. But here's Alberti. He goes to school with this guy, not everybody's favorite dude, Barzizza, Gasparino Barzizza. And Barzizza sets up a school because he's got access to all these guys discovering these books. These are his buddies, Guarino, Poggio, Vittorio. They're all the guys discovering the books at the end of the 1300s are his pals. So he gets to teach Alberti and others, we don't know, age of maybe 10 to 18, at least a whole bunch of years, enough to have Alberti write a Roman play in Latin and pass it off as real, as antique. That's how smart he is by the ages of 18, 19. This is another clue. He didn't go to Florence to write this book in 9 months, 10 months. But Barzizza, when one reads his curriculum and one reads what he was giving Alberti, not to mention the guest lecturers, and not to mention he invented the field trip, right? Are you in Padua and you're not going to go see Giotto? Come on. You're not going to go see Altichiero, two of the granddaddies of realism, the connective tissue of all contemporary art, as far as I'm concerned, or Giotto and Altichiero. You've got an opportunity to do that, plus which you've got every single great humanist from all the different places, from the Gonzaga family, from the Este family, you got all these guys coming to lecture. So I'm being Alberti for a second. I said, man, if I get to learn Latin like that and get to hear the Greek guys talk about Greek, and I get to walk around Padua and look at the art with a teacher who actually writes a kid's father. The father says he seemed a little depressed at school. And Barzizza writes, I think it's about 1414, he writes this letter. It says, take the kid out and show him some art. The art gets him out of his head. It's just not all in your head. So if I'm studying with a guy like that, that's so far ahead of the jam, man, and then I got to go to school and learn law, I don't know. I might go the Alberti route, go like, man, I feel like bailing on this. I don't know. And so I was sitting in Bologna. This got to be 2011 or something like that, or maybe 2012. And seeing where the records of that fire, because of his, from 1421 to 1428, the records are gone because they were burned. But I'm looking at the curriculum of 1421, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, I mean, he's there in 1421, but we don't know where he went after that. I think he went to Northern Europe. I think Barzizza's, one of his best friends was the Archbishop of Bologna, Albergati. And Albergati was going to the Council of Constance and going north and so forth. And then we have evidence that Barzizza was in Bologna while Alberti was there. This is an assumption, but he's got a classic polymath student. You think he's not going to introduce him? This archbishop who's traveling the world as a humanist Catholic and say, hey, man, this guy can write anything for you? Yeah, so I think he went to, because all of his architecture books sort of point to the fact that he's looking at Northern European architecture. And the great thing is that I'd get bored with school too, man. If I had the education in Padua that I had from Barzizza, and then I had to go to college, listen to somebody drone on about canon law, I'd go, nah. And he writes, you know, memos, and he starts writing about his family. I'd bail, man. If somebody offered me a gig, I'm out. I'm gone.
On that note about education and this kind of universal education, this kind of everything is becoming more and more specialized now. And this kind of education that you've had, which is at the same time autodidactic, even though you've got your doctorate, you have your PhD, but you've also learned from the world. You learn from Sidney Lumet, right. All these people, Miles Davis, all these people you've worked and acted alongside. It's not just the theory of the world. It's the real world. What's it like? And now we're facing the AI revolution where people, I think it's going to push people more into their little rabbit holes, screen life. They can write their stories for them, even their music. I don't want to think about it. This was a problem. It's a problem. You're not going to get that 60s protest music you were talking about. So you, with all that you've known and all that you've taught yourself and all that you've learned from the people you've collaborated with, your friends and colleagues, what for you, you've talked about your important teachers, but the value of education, but also educating yourself about the world. What, you know, what are your reflections on education as we are now, as we move into the synthetic AI and over-specialized world where people kind of don't know anything but their bubble?
Well, that's a problem right there. But that's been a problem for some time. I hope that they go back to it. Look, I can't really incarcerate the modus or the context of education now about kids staying in the bubble. You know, my kid is 13. He's smart as a whip. He snuck a switch into a bathroom and they were all on his switch. And him and five kids went on detention, got put on detention for carrying the switch. So look, the bubble is the choice of acknowledgement and integrity. That's the only bubble I'm concerned about. The choice of compassion and so forth. So my son was telling me, justifying the future by they not allowing these things right anywhere near a classroom where he has to write cursive and all that jazz. He snuck it into the bathroom and five guys were on it to show how fast this thing was going. He says, this is science, Dad. If you can, your bubble is technology and AI. It's not mine. But I have to say, my bubble was a particular thing and I had to come out of it and go back and learn stuff. We expect every generation to learn what we've learned, but it took me a lifetime to learn this stuff. I did not come out of college with a manifest interest in or manifest fascination with how the world works. I came out of college with a desire to win or whatever. And thank God I went to New York on my own, despite everybody said you're going to die there, and made my own life out of it, carved my own life. And that's the thing my dad gave me, is perseverance and discipline. Get up and do it. But I had no interest in the world. I had an interest in the world as far as Vietnam being over. But as far as the historical circumstances of what this fed me, none. I got it later on. So I'm hoping that somewhere along the line, the people that live in their own bubble right now and whatever AI will take over, you can't stop it. You cannot stop that. You can't stop the progression of people moving. People will move to where the market value is. And also you cannot stop science. You can't do it unless you suppress it and shoot everybody and go, okay, we're going back to the dark ages and we're burning the books. But you can't, not going to do it now because there's too much out there and it's all in space. But let me ask you this, Mia, when you're in your own bubble, can you ever break it? Well, that's the thing.
We always want, we all have our tribes, but the thing is, on the thing about AI, I did speak to this French paleoanthropologist, and he's an expert in Neanderthals. And he says, Neanderthals, by the way, were very creative. That's what he studied from looking at their tools. Each tool looked like different, like a different sculpture. They were artists, like he says, but they were
very advanced. Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't hyper efficient like the sapiens at that time. So all the sapiens tools look the same. And now we're kind of on this new threshold looking at AI, which is becoming smarter than us and can surpass and more efficient. That's what it really is. And we're like the Neanderthals looking at that. And at one point, the young generation, it comes a time and they kind of throw away what the old folks know and they think, I'm going this new path. And at that point, he says that we could, you know, abandon aspects of our humanity, you know, and follow the path.
But that's right. And Arthur C. Clarke and Philip K. Dick.
Yeah.
Philip K. Dick and Arthur C. Clarke are rolling in their graves right now.
I know.
What the heck were they writing? They were writing essentially the consciousness of the machine.
And yeah. You've acted. I want to end on this.
What are you doing, Steve? That's the only thing I'm going to remind you of this. You know that line?
Oh, yeah. Steve from Hal.
Yes. What are you doing, Steve?
Oh, that's so creepy.
Isn't it? But you know, when you're stoned in 1969 and you watch that, you go like, oh, wow, is that creepy? And now, what, 50 years later, 50-something years later, and you're thinking, no.
Well, I want to ask, because when you look at your film and television career, a lot of that is RoboCop or I Love Naked Lunch, and you've like Sons of Anarchy, and you've all the Hawaii Five-0. So it's a lot, not into the future, it's very contemporary. Then you're going, and that's, you know, the art of movement, and when you're a director, I imagine all these moving parts, you have to work quickly, you have to command teams, and it's a world you know about. Then you go into this art historical world, which is like maybe looking at one painting for years and an archaeology of trying to understand the history of it. And it's the mystery, trying to piece together this archaeology of it. Does one inform the other? Does one give you a thirst for the other? Like, how does that, you know, the imagination when you're writing about things you can't exactly know? Just if you could expand a little bit on that for us.
Yeah. My favorite painter is a guy from Messina named Antonello, who you probably know of, this guy. If you Google him, Sage, you Google Antonello da Messina. First guy to use oil in Italy. First guy to use the plasticity of the skin. First guy to use drama, paint from the life instead of the type, and all sorts of stuff. And Mia was talking about being an outsider. So I have to give this paper in the Renaissance Society called, it's an intellectual panel. It's not an art history panel. It's an intellectual panel. And it's called Outsiders from Venice. And it's about all the people who weren't from Venice, who made good in Venice, but then eventually had to leave. And Antonello made good in Venice as one of those people. So it's an art historical paper in a panel on intellectual. I'm going to read you something. Just will give you a lowdown on what it is that feeds me. If I could just read you this beginning. Okay, this is called Flourish of an Outsider, a panel on Venetian Outsiders from Venice, Renaissance Society of America, which is essentially the world Renaissance. This Flourish of an Outsider, the Brief Brilliance of Antonello da Messina. Okay, here it is. As a Johnny come lately to Renaissance art, in gratitude to Vittorio Storaro, Maria Connelli, and the late wonderful Walter Lead Cave, the Metropolitan Museum in New York, when I first saw the Ecce Homo, that's Here is Man, it comes out of the Book of John, where Jesus is held up to the crowd. I first saw the Ecce Homo at the Met, and you guys should Google this. Ecce Homo, Metropolitan Museum in New York. You see this boxer, a pugilist, as Jesus with a bad mustache. Is he handsome? No. Does he look like Robert Redford? No. Does he have blonde hair? No. Does he look like a thug? Yeah. When I first saw the Ecce Homo at the Met, executed in Venice by Antonello da Messina, that painter instantly became my own private Idaho, poo-pooed later on, and this is in the 1990s, by the way, poo-pooed later on by graduate classmates as second tier compared to the Florence and its Ninja Turtles of Raffaello, etc. My jam was akin to heralding Bob Dylan as a real-life poet, the real-deal poet, in the face of, in 1960s, of Cummings or Eliot or Wallace Stevens, etc. Subsequently, thanks to the 21st century bringing around events like Keith Curtis and Andrea Bear at the Met's 2005 poignant exhibit, and Mauro Luco's brilliant 2000 show at the Scuderia di Cornali in Rome, as well as a plethora of 21st century scholarship and revived stuff, Antonello has enjoyed a fresh blast of merited attention and now seems to be everybody's pet painter of the Renaissance, which honestly, I resent a bit. But then again, Bob Dylan won the 2016 Literature Nobel Prize as a poet, no less. So the point of this is that everybody's idea of the thing is not the thing. You got to step out of the bubble. Listen, I came in tied for first the Texas State Poetry Reading Contest reading a Bob Dylan. If I'd have done this in 1968 and said, this is Bob Dylan, I'd have been shot in Lubbock, Texas, or Texas Tech, or, you know, or run out of town. But I was reading Ultra Robert McLeish, William Blake, and an anonymous poem. It's actually Bob Dylan's Spanish Harlem Incident. Okay? Now everybody says he's a poet. Great. Now they made a movie. He's probably going to win the Oscar. Great. Can't do that in 68. So it's all a shift, and it's all a shift in me. It's definitely all a shift. So what I'm trying to give you is this sense that no matter what we label or fear or think of something now, it ain't what it's going to be in 40 years, man.
But that's what I love about you, because there isn't a sense of high and low. You can bring the sense of the way, like a street knowledge or like an intimacy of it. And, you know, it's not like poetry up here, you know, music
I know,
down
but you know,
here.
Mia, yeah. Let me interrupt for a second. You live in the city with the very first academy to preserve its own language. But, you know, the language changes from the street up. It don't change, just as like Noam Chomsky said in all of the great linguists, it doesn't change from the aristocracy down. The street changes the language. And also there's guys they didn't want in there. There's guys that the academy later on accepted, like Genet and so forth. But man, you think if Jean Genet, if he was around in 1880, that they would have let him into the Academy Française?
No, he still is radical. I mean, he's totally radical.
You know who this is, Sage, you were talking about? Genet?
He's a playwright. He wrote about street stuff.
Yeah.
Thieves,
Sage,
yeah.
He was one of the first people other than William Burroughs, who I played, or Pier Paolo Pasolini, to say, I'm queer. And F you if you don't dig it. And to have the guts to say that in the 40s, and post-war, you get killed for it, is tough. And his sort of mentor was Jean Cocteau, who bailed him out of jail. I think Cocteau bailed him out of jail 5 times. I read this.
Yeah, he wrote about prison and relationships, you know, homosexual relationships within
and
prison.
Thieves, and he wrote plays about the hierarchy of people who are like scratching and who don't realize they're under the domination of the wealth anyway. So why are they even scratching for a play? He's a real nihilist, fantastic, satirical guy, man. And now he's like heralded.
Same with Caravaggio. I mean, when you think about the Renaissance, of course, for years he was, people
passé.
Had forgotten.
Well, here's the thing, you know, Mia, during his time, thanks to Borghese and those guys, he was a king. He was like Michelangelo. And it's after he dies in Porto Cervo, and then it's sort of, they go on to essentially Rococo and everything after the Baroque. They're not interested in that anymore. And it's like, but it's Roberto Longhi, the great Roberto Longhi, revives him. But the Renaissance is revived in the early 20th century. The whole Renaissance, in the face of this art movement we talked about, this bubble we're talking about, is considered naive. Come on. Moses and Jesus paintings? Really? Who wants that? I want to know about the inner psyche. This is the distinction between the Iliad and the Odyssey, which I've taught Doc. You can tell the cows come home. This is interesting for Sage. You know, until the 20th century or late 19th century, Sage, people want the Iliad. They want power, glory, vengeance, sex, brutality, murder, all the great things of stereotypical melodrama, right? The Odyssey is blown off as like a touchy-feely sort of metaphysical piece of what? The guy wants to find his wife and kids? What's the heroism in that, man? Interesting. Okay, he meets a witch and he hears the siren sing and la, 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 la. We could say it's the Industrial Revolution. We could say it's like gas warfare, feminism, Freudianism, whatever, World War I. The fall of the Habsburg Empire, but people in the 20th century are obsessed now with the Odyssey. How do I find my place in the sun? How do I find my bubble? How do I find my own jam, my gang, my thing, my safety? You know, the heck with this world war lunacy, man. So that's where we are now, and I kind of dig it that everybody's looking for his own private Idaho, man.
It's tough times, and I don't know. I think of you as being at one, you know, very international and maverick. And then sometimes there's something to your core, like growing up in Wisconsin and just being at the core of these in Los Angeles, you know, is also being very American, and you're a strange American.
I'm a strange American. Look, let me put it this
you're
way.
You're not a quiet American.
No, my dear friend, my dear friend, Treat Williams, who bless his heart, a great actor, and he died in a motorcycle crash 3 years back, which really broke my heart because I hung out with Treat a long time, but. You know, my whole thing is, thanks to my mother, is jazz. My whole obsession. That's how I got to meet Miles, because every time I was interviewed for a movie, I would turn the conversation back to jazz and start talking about Miles or Coltrane or Duke or somebody. And so by the time I met Miles, Miles knew he had a sucker walking in, you know, because all these people, because by that time I knew Herbie Hancock, I knew Wayne Shorter, I knew Ron Carter, I knew all the greats, man. And they'd all told him, you know, this actor guy is constantly talking about you. So he knew he had like a total sycophant. Walking in that dressing room. But Treat, bless his heart. You know, because my language has always been with man and cool and jazz and bop and the rebop of jazz talk. And Treat said, Peter, you know what? You know who you really are? You're a middle-class white boy posing as a black hipster. I said, Treat, you know what? I think you pinned me, man. I think that's going to stay with me forever. I am a middle-class white boy posing as a black hipster. And with that, that's going to make me, I promise myself I won't weep. But the thing, I think it's in the diary, but my mom said that if I was God, because I walked Miles Davis to his car with Bob Thiel Jr., whose dad produced Train. And we're backstage at Hollywood Bowl, the last gig he ever played. And Miles asked me, who's that white boy? I said, it's Bob Thiel Jr., great music supervisor. He says, his dad produced Train? I said, yeah. Walked up to Bob and said, you know, your father took Coltrane out of my band. I said, yeah. He says, your father produced Train. He says, yeah. He says, well, you can hang in permission. And we walked out. I did not know he was dying. I did not know he was sick. I kissed him on both cheeks, and 18 days later, he was dead. And I told my mother that. My mother said, you know, if I was God and I was thinking of somebody to say goodbye for all of us, I say that in the thing. You know, who better than a white boy? I've been listening to him since he was 11. Yeah.
Well, that's the outsider thing, because you can recognize it, because it's something you missed in your own life, but you can recognize it. And I think that that's actually, you know, that's what art does. It speaks across cultures, across time, and just connects with us before we can even think about it.
I think that that's what, when I was making that joke about Dr. Cynthia, I told this guy 2 weeks ago, he says, yes, but you know, you're right that art is considered, you know, pretentious and hoopla and sort of the extremity of indulged. In truth, it's what you just said, Mia. Art transcends time and culture. That's the beauty of it. I mean, I was just in Japan like 9 months ago, once again, looking at the art and looking at the dance, and we saw this whole kabuki theater piece, which you have to pay big money and have to wait in line, have to buy it and wait in advance. And I think, my God, the sounds and the drums and musical instruments and the absolute harmony of this chaos, because it sounds to the Western ear like chaos, but it's actually harmonious. That transcends culture, it transcends time, it transcends all of it. I think that's maybe that is the greatest gift of art, transcendence.
It's a beautiful note to end on. So thank you, Peter Weller, for sharing your spirit of the Renaissance and jazz and your polymath curiosity across the performing and visual arts, and for tuning us onto Leon Battista Alberti and helping us understand the people, psychology, and places that inform great works of art. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you, Mia.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Sage Shumate with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Sage Shumate. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community, exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.